Today, I'd like to welcome to the PodMD studio, Dr. Deepa Gopinath. Deepa Gopinath is a urogynecologist with dual subspecialist qualifications from Australia and the United Kingdom. She is the lead clinician for urogynecology at the Nepean Hospital in Western Sydney and treats women with pelvic floor problems. She has several special interests, including recurrent prolapse and incontinence, but is passionate about the pelvic floor problems in women at the end of the spectrum from postpartum to frail elderly. She is actively involved in creating multidisciplinary team models, improving access to health information to the women, and shared decision-making. She has also published and presented widely. Today, we'll be discussing the topic of obesity and pelvic floor disorders. We do hope you enjoy this podcast, but please remember that the advice here is of a general nature and is not intended as specific advice about a given patient. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the doctor, not PodMD. If you do have a patient on whom you require specific advice, then please seek advice from a colleague with appropriate expertise in that area. Deepa, thanks for talking with us on PodMD today.
Thank you for having me.
The topic of today's discussion is obesity and pelvic floor disorders. Deepa, can you please give us a brief overview about obesity and pelvic floor disorders?
Absolutely. So, as you know, obesity is the new epidemic of the world, and every third or fourth patient that might be coming to see you is likely to be obese, especially in the Western world. And especially in this, in Australasia, you'll find that in the Pacific Islander group, it's actually even higher than that, and it's perhaps one to two. Now, we do know quite well the impact of obesity on general health and conditions like diabetes, etc. But what is not so well known is its impact on the pelvic floor. And I can tell you that this is a risk factor for pelvic floor disorders.
How does obesity contribute to the development of pelvic floor disorders?
So as you can imagine, if there is excessive weight gain, there is going to be a proportionate strain on the pelvic floor structures, which includes the muscles, the connective tissue, and the nerves, and that can cause damage and weakness. And as a result of this, you can get symptoms like urinary and fecal incontinence, as well as pelvic organ prolapse. Now, it's not just the weight in itself. There is also a metabolic element that you see with obesity due to the abnormal glucose metabolism, the atherosclerotic changes, which can cause ischemia, and that can cause a direct impact on the nerve and the muscle function of the bladder or the pelvic floor structures in general, and predisposing you to pelvic floor disorder. So it's not just the weight in itself.
What is the impact of obesity on pelvic floor disorders?
So, as we just said, obesity is a risk factor for pelvic floor disorders. And if we were to look at pelvic floor disorders, we want to sort of divide them into four different domains, like the bladder, the prolapse, the bowel, and also the sexual function. So, with respect to the bladder, once the body mass index, which is a measure of, weight in health. Once the body mass index is over 30, which is when it's classed as obesity, you are 4 to 5 times more likely to experience urinary leakage. Even a small increase in BMI from 30 to 35, for example, can increase your urinary leakage by 20 to 70%. So it's like a geometric relationship. And this applies not only to the stress urinary incontinence, which is the leakage with physical exertion like coughing, sneezing, etc., but also with urge urinary incontinence, which is the leakage with urgent urination. And it's not only that this increases your risk for the leakage. If you did choose a surgical procedure to improve the incontinence, the obesity still has an impact and reduces your success rate from surgery compared to the non-obese. So that was on the bladder. In terms of prolapse, which is where there is a a protrusion or a vaginal lump, which is the commonest symptoms described by patients, having obesity increases your chances of having a prolapse and also the chance of this worsening over time. Now, interestingly, with bowels, it's slightly conflicting, but overall the consensus seems to be that it doesn't really have a huge impact with either difficulty with bowel movement or leakage. And the last, but the, you know, an important function of the vagina, which is sexual function, it's again quite tricky to measure the direct impact of obesity itself, because obesity itself can cause some mental health problems or, you know, a different body image, and all of that can have impact with sexual function. So it's difficult to know how much of that is due to the obesity in itself. But overall, as you can see, it has got impact on the bladder and the vagina predominantly.
What are the treatment options?
So generally, the treatment options remain more or less the same, whether you are obese or non-obese. So most of the time when a patient, you know, comes to see you in clinic, you're looking to see what are the reversible factors here that I can improve, and also the non-surgical or conservative options that you can advocate for the patient to improve the pelvic floor health. So most of the time, this includes pelvic floor exercises, medications, especially if it's overactive bladder, or pessaries if they have pelvic organ prolapse. But the most important thing is managing the weight, which has got an important role in the treatment strategy. And this is where a GP can be incredibly helpful in terms of health education, because it's not just the pelvic floor, the other outcomes from weight loss in itself, and also supporting the patient's journey with their weight loss.
Can you explain further how weight loss helps in the treatment of pelvic floor disorders?
Absolutely. So often with weight loss, we're not talking about getting their body mass index back to normal BMI. We're talking about a small drop in their weight. It could be anywhere from 5 to 10%. And we know that a 5% weight loss can lead to 50% improvement in their stress urinary incontinence symptoms. And this can be achieved by just managing their weight with diet, exercise, and medication. Similarly, for overactive bladder, we found that weight loss can lead to up to 70% improvement of symptoms. So it just shows that with respect to bladder, just weight loss itself is a good treatment option that can improve their symptoms by 50% and also perhaps avoid surgical management. Now, when it comes to prolapse, it's slightly different. If it is in the early stages of prolapse, we know that it does prevent progression of prolapse symptoms. However, if they are in the advanced stages, so for example, stage 3 and 4, where there is protrusion of the prolapse beyond the entrance of the vagina, you often find that it doesn't really achieve in reversing the anatomical changes. However, these are the patients you would consider for surgery. So in terms of managing the surgical risks these patients would take, weight loss is certainly helpful in reducing complications related to the surgery, the recovery, and also the anaesthetic.
What are the specific issues you worry about considering surgery for these patients?
So I would think the main concern with any surgery or main difference you want to see is an improved treatment outcome. And generally, if you take stress incontinence surgery as an example, and if you chose the gold standard, which is a retropubic mid-urethral sling, which is a synthetic sling, another way, mesh, vaginal mesh, we find a 80 to 90% improvement or cure of stress incontinence, in an average patient. However, if you add obesity into this equation, we find that this outcome is reduced. It can be as low as 50 to 70%, especially in the long term. So we know that generally pelvic floor disorders get worse as patients get older. So especially in the long term, these patients are more likely to come back to you with recurrent urinary incontinence than somebody else who is non-obese. So the success of treatment is lower than average. But also, when you have obesity, they also come with other medical comorbidities that needs to be managed appropriately prior to considering surgery. And also, there are anesthetic challenges with, you know, intubation and ventilation. And also, post-operatively, they're more at risk of wound infection or blood clots, etc. So they are challenging patients with higher risk for surgery and not necessarily get the same outcome as somebody else with normal weight.
What specific strategies do you propose for weight loss?
So weight management is always a sensitive topic, and often the ladies that come and see me share stories about their different diets and, you know, the exercises and everything that they have tried to help in reducing their weight. They often feel that medical practitioners especially are quite judgmental when it comes to weight. It's often implied that it's because of their lifestyle factors and their lack of exercise, poor diet, etc. Whereas we know that this is not the case, and there is a genetic predisposition which is why majority of the ladies are that way, in the first place. So it's acknowledging that and not being judgmental and being very sympathetic with your approach. And often the place to start is by reassuring them that we're not looking to achieve a normal BMI here. We want to achieve a 5 to 10% weight loss, which is often enough to improve their symptoms. And is giving them a weight as a target, which they also feel is realistic, and giving them some time frames to achieve that. Now, once they do achieve the weight, we do want them to maintain it and not gain further, which is easier said than done. And that is, again, another challenge with obesity, because your body is set to in a certain, I forget the term for it, but in a certain way that it always tries to achieve the previous weight as normal rather than the newly gained normal weight. And often just telling a patient that you've got to lose a certain amount of weight alone doesn't really work. And most of the time it's best achieved with multidisciplinary care. And that is where the GP is, again, very important, being the link and the one who constantly reviews their weight loss journey. Obviously, you want your dietitians who can help support the diets that you would prescribe, exercise physiologists who can support with the exercise. And a lot of the time they need some mental support as well, and that is where a psychologist or a life coach is helpful in giving them behavioral strategies. I can see some of the programs like Noom and that comes up on social media where they specifically target this aspect of weight gain, which is successful. So it has to be a multi-disciplinary approach for weight loss.
What role does the GP play in the treatment of the condition?
So as we said before, we would have started the conversation about weight loss in the clinic and just explaining to them how it impacts on their pelvic floor symptoms and what happens if you did consider surgery, that it's not going to achieve the ideal success rate that I would want to see in a patient. So they're often engaged and interested in that journey to support their own good outcomes. And we would then ask them to go and discuss this further with their GP practitioner. So often the things we would have discussed are the various diets. I won't go into the details of it, but the one that we specifically discussed with them in terms of acute weight loss prior to surgical procedure would be the very low energy diets. Now, again, this may not be practical or ideal for somebody with medical conditions, so we often ask them to discuss that with a GP further or seek the help of a dietitian. Certainly medical therapy, we mentioned the names, but again, we ask them to explore that further with their GP, whether that is the Ozempic or other appetite suppressants, etc., and also the cost barriers that the patient has. So we ask them to discuss that further with you. Exercise we often find is like a double-edged sword for our patients, because a lot of these patients with pelvic floor problems cannot exercise due to the problems themselves, whether that's a leakage or the prolapse. So, and also a lot of them are elderly and have limited mobility, you know, by the age factor itself. So we sometimes have to be more realistic in terms of the strenuous exercise you would want them to carry out for their weight loss, and, you know, reset that at the level where you just want to preserve the muscle mass and strength rather than have that as a weight loss strategy. So those are the conversation that we would have had with a patient, but we do know in the long term, medical therapy is inferior to surgical therapy. So weight loss surgery certainly has got a better long-term success rate in terms of reducing weight and maintaining weight. But again, this is not something we would be discussing with them, and we would feel that it will be more appropriate at the level of a GP setting in liaison with a metabolic clinic to make these discussions happen and to support the weight loss journey.
Thank you for your time here today in the PodMD studio. To sum up for us, could you please identify the three key take-home messages from today's podcast on obesity and pelvic floor disorders?
So I think I've summarized the impact of obesity on pelvic floor symptoms and the fact that some of these changes are reversible. So I feel patient education clearly has a role in achieving realistic targets, thereby getting good outcomes and also maintaining this in the long run. And clearly this has to be achieved in a multidisciplinary way with the specialist, the GP, and all the other allied health specialists, and perhaps in liaison with the metabolic clinic as well.
Thank you again for your time and the insights you've provided.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure talking to you today.